Great.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Lisa, and thank you for asking me to come here and for setting up this this colloquium. I'm particularly pleased because I guess I would like there to be a processual revolution. I'm not sure whether there is one yet, but perhaps this is one of those events that might help it to come about. So thank you very much. Okay, so here's an overview of... oh, that's not what I was supposed to do. I did that all wrong. Okay. I think I can maybe... no. Go back. Sorry about this. can you see the which is the slideshow?
I should be there. Play from start.
Okay, I think I've... Right, okay. Awkward beginning. Right, so here is an overview of what I want to talk about. Now, obviously, the title is not to be taken as it might to suggesting that nothing is alive. The emphasis, of course, is on the word things. What I want to argue is that living beings are, in fact, not things but processes. So I will begin by saying a very little, not nearly enough, but about the difference between things and processes. And then I want to go on and explain why organisms in particular are processes, not things. And I guess for obvious reasons, this is the level of organization that people tend to think of when they think about life. I will then say something about the relation to other levels of biological organization, and so to give a broader overview of what I understand a processual view of life to involve. And finally, I want to say something about some indications of why I think this matters. And I'll spend a few minutes talking about why it matters that, of course, we as organisms are ourselves processes rather than things. I begin with a slight, let's say, methodological digression. I just wanted to say a word on the topic which I take this to be, which is the metaphysics of biology. Perhaps a somewhat controversial idea. And I start with, I guess, every philosopher of science, at least perhaps many philosophers' favorite kind of one-line statement of what philosophy is about. Well, perhaps not philosophers of science, perhaps some of them wouldn't like this so much, but at any rate, I like it, the aim of philosophy being to understand the very general nature of things, how things hang together in a broad sense. This I take it to be metaphysics, so if philosophy of science is philosophy, it should be at least part of what we do to answer this kind of question. And a slightly less familiar figure, I will now, oh, Jesus, I guess that's very strange. I guess I maybe now go back and revisit my unwillingness to have these slides copyrighted, because I think the copyright police must have come along. And that's really odd. Never seen that happen before. Anyhow, that was a picture of Joseph Henry Woodger, a philosopher of biology from a little while ago, working in the middle of the last century. And he has this very nice quote that I like to use. Physiologists who suppose themselves to be above metaphysics are only a very little above it, being up to the neck in it. And I guess the point being that I would claim, as I think would many others, that you can't actually do philosophy of science, you can't even do science without assuming a lot of metaphysics. You have to have some general view of what the world is like that you're trying to understand. Okay, so I'm going backwards now. Interesting. Okay, right. So things and processes. So what do I mean by a thing, which I say, of course, there are no biological ones. So I'm really here, and I guess, as I said, this will have to be much too brief. I'm really alluding to essentially the dominant theme in the history of Western philosophy. I should stress the Western, because things are quite different, I think, if you look at particularly Indian philosophy, to some degree Chinese philosophy. But since I don't know enough about these to talk about them, I just say this as a necessary disclaimer. But the Western tradition has, I think, seen the world as, by and large, has seen the world as composed of things. Things or substances entities that have properties, and importantly, they have, in most versions, they have essential properties, and essential properties that tell you what kind of thing the thing is, or indeed what that individual thing is. And this turns out to be something that's actually very hard to escape from in an ontology of things, because of the problem of understanding what it is for a thing to persist through time. And the answer generally to that is it has to keep most of the same properties, but how many and which and so on. And this, of course, has been generally answered by distinguishing between essential and accidental properties. A thing remains the same as long as some essential property or set of essential properties remains fixed. A thing is also thought of as autonomous. It doesn't depend on anything else for its existence, or its relations to anything else for its existence. Again, this is the typical way this has been understood. And of course, the classic expression of such a view is in atomism. Now, I draw a kind of an old-fashioned picture of an atom there, though not as old-fashioned as if it had just been one little ball, because I guess here we're halfway to a view in which the atoms themselves aren't at all like things, and you know, so I think Nicholas Rescher, who is one of the few really committed process philosophers in recent history, says, modern physics puts money in the process philosopher's bank. But I won't go into that, I think it's a very important for the general defensibility of a thoroughly processual view, one that I'm certainly drawn to, which is, say, processes all the way down. But for the purposes of this talk, I'm only going to be concerned with biology. At any rate, so I said things are stable, they're autonomous, and crucially, I think, for understanding what's wrong with this for biology, the default state of a thing is stasis. It doesn't. If a thing changes its properties, that's something that requires explanation. Left to itself, it stays the same. And obviously, here are just medium-sized dry goods like a table, a classic example, but also big dry goods like planet here. Question, obviously, things or entities like this, are these counted as things? We obviously know my answer to that. So what's a process? So for process philosophy, unlike thing philosophy, being is always dynamic. What we think of as things are, and it's obviously a metaphor, but I think it's a very useful one, are eddies in a fundamental flow of process. And of course, rivers figured largely in the very early history of process thinking. And the crucial thing, the inversion from the view of the world of composed of things or substances, is it's actually the stability of what we are inclined to think of as things that requires explanation. Processes require activity for their continuing existence. And, standard examples of, there's a river that we have there, more familiar in philosophy, where, mostly we have most of thing philosophers think there are also processes, and we'll give examples like a battle, which obviously if everybody stops doing anything, the battle has ended. And actually zooming in on the planet I showed in the last slide, we have my favorite little process, which is the Great Red Spot on Jupiter. And I guess it's my favorite because it's a very, very stable eddy, in the sense that it's been around as long as anybody's had telescopes that could see it, at any rate. Of course, it's changed a bit over that time, but it persists, and it persists because of the flow of winds, that very high velocity winds over the surface of the planet that maintain it. And of course, again, we have the question whether these are processes, and I guess I don't need to tell you what my view of that is. So, just again, another little digression. Of course, I said, you know, we're talking about a revolution in process philosophy. It's not that nobody's ever thought of process philosophy at all. And indeed, you can argue, I think, that the very dawn of Western philosophy can be seen as kind of delineated by the views of Heraclitus and Parmenides, and put in the crudest possible way, Heraclitus claimed that everything changes, and Parmenides claimed that nothing changes. That's pretty diametrically opposite views of the world. And rather astonishingly, I would say, Parmenides decisively won the battle in Western philosophy. And I guess perhaps the final battle was in the Scientific Revolution, when atomism became very popular. But I think generally in philosophy, most philosophers in the Western tradition have thought the world was ultimately composed of substances. There is a number of people who have been occasionally enlisted as process philosophers or process philosophers manque, Leibniz, Hegel, sometimes the American pragmatists. And then I guess the person who I must say a word about, Alfred North Whitehead, who has now become almost synonymous with process philosophy. And I have to say, though I have a great deal of respect for Whitehead's work, I'm inclined to think that his association with it is one of the reasons why process philosophy is less fashionable than it might otherwise be. Because Whitehead, it's an explicit decision in the project that I've been involved with to divorce the project from Whitehead scholarship. Because generally, if you look for, look up process philosophy nowadays and Google it, what you'll find is Whitehead scholars often arguing with one another about what Whitehead said. An easy argument to understand, because Whitehead is, whatever you think of him, a fairly obscure philosopher. And I really didn't want to get sidetracked into these sorts of debates about what Whitehead really meant. I also didn't want to get involved, as the Whitehead's philosophy is presented, at least in its kind of classic formulation, in terms of a huge array of technical terminology, which again I think is off-putting to a lot of casual observers. There are issues that I didn't really want to get into. His philosophy is very much tied up with panpsychism, with theology. And then finally, I actually think that Whitehead isn't really a process philosopher at all. If you actually look at the system as he sets it out in Process and Reality, is ultimately an atomist philosophy. Whitehead, in the end, everything comes down to what he calls actual occasions, and actual occasions, at least as I understand them, don't themselves change. I would like to defend a process philosophy that is processes all the way down. But anyway, I might be wrong about this interpretation of Whitehead. I can cite some more knowledgeable people in support of it, but I really don't want to get into that. This is just to say, this is the last time I will mention Whitehead in this talk. So, move on to organisms. And why think of organisms as processes? Well, I've got three reasons, each of which I think is decisive, so I will say a little bit about those. The first is quite uncontroversial. Organisms are not stable entities. They are systems very far from thermodynamic equilibrium, and a constant turnover of matter and energy maintains the degree of structure they have, that they maintain. Secondly, organisms, again uncontroversially, have life cycles, and different stages of life cycles are often very different from one another. And third, finally, organisms have very loosely fixed boundaries. This is probably the controversial claim I'll make. It's at least something that I find it's impossible to convince metaphysicians of, who are primarily metaphysicians, only secondarily interested in biology. But I want to say that the omnipresence of symbiosis actually makes it very hard to define unambiguous boundaries for organisms. And of course, what this also shows is that organisms are, even if you think they have sharp boundaries, are anything but autonomous, i.e. they're constantly dependent on their interactions with many other entities, as well, of course, as the first point there. They have to interact with the world to stabilize, to maintain their stability, but they also have obligatory relations with a whole array of other organisms. And I'll just quickly say a bit more about these points. I don't think really I need to say more about the first, as I say, it's quite uncontroversial, but sometimes not adequately noticed, I think, in talking about what these entities are. And also with life cycles, it's just a little reminder that life cycles are often enormously complex. I mean, we're all familiar with the insect life cycle and the frog life cycle. If you start looking at some of these sea creatures, the life cycles become absolutely baroque, and all kinds of very different entities are involved. And trying to make an argument that that somehow these are all the same thing is very difficult in terms of the traditional philosophical account of thing. Now, what I want to say is that they're nevertheless the same process. What makes a process the same? And again, I have to be much too quick at this, but I think the answer is actually relatively simple. It's kind of causal and spatiotemporal continuity. Now, of course, if that seems a bit vague, that's good, because I think it should be a bit vague, because I think the division of the world into organisms is actually really underdetermined by the phenomena. And, oh, is this some new thing that Google has done? Or is it something about the this is terrible. I don't know what will anyhow. I'll have to try and manage with what we have. So this is a picture of humans and the multitude of microbes with which they coexist, with various degrees of obligatoriness and various degrees of transience. But I guess we're all familiar now with the idea that, you know, we've greatly underestimated the importance of our guts, particularly, but also other systems of microbes that coexist with us. Again, maybe a little less familiar, the relations between insects and various symbionts that vary from fully obligatory, even to the extent that the bacteria live only inside their cells, to more or less complex. So I was going to look at the pictures and remember what I was going to say. More or less transitory relations. No, I really don't remember what these pictures were. Oh, no, I do now. Yes, I was also going to mention plants have the root systems in particular are connected to very complex. I had a nice picture of a tree with mushrooms growing around it, which, of course, all part of a system. Most of the time, the mushrooms exist as a mycelial web underneath the ground. Every now and again, the mushrooms, sometimes tasty, come up. There are all kinds of fascinating things about this, that actually creating connections between plants that share the mycelial web. Okay, well, I guess this is looks like some awful censorship kind of, you know. Anyway, so this is an older slide, I'm glad to say, so the pictures have survived. So just as I say, one of my favourite examples, just to look at a really complex system, and interestingly, a massively successful system. I mean, these things are, you know, a substantial part of the invertebrate biomass in the systems where they exist. I like to think of this picture as two metaphysicians trying to dig their way out of a hole, but actually, it's this is not quite correct. This is a couple of entomologists excavating one of these systems, and I won't again go into much of the complexity. One of the very interesting things is this. Is this point? No, we probably don't know about yet. This thing here is what's usually referred to as the stomach of the system, which consists of fungus that digests the leaves that various of these ants bring into the colony to feed it. And there are all kinds of other sets of bacteria that actually evolved in breaking down the leaves. It isn't done originally by the fungi, that have antibiotic functions. There are a different set of funguses in the waste system. There's also these ants have endosymbiotic bacteria, Wolbachia, that probably are actually running the whole show, because these often determine sex ratios or crucial things such as this. And anyway, my point about all this is, where is the organism here? Now, you mostly look at an ant and think that's an organism. A lot of biologists have said, no, it's actually, it's a superorganism, the whole colony, the ants are really parts of an organism. But then what about the fungi and the bacteria, which are essential parts of the superorganism? Couldn't digest anything if it didn't have the symbiotic fungi. When the queens take off to sign a new colony, they take a bit of fungus with them, as well as their, obviously, their more familiar biological bits and pieces. So what I want to say is, there really isn't an answer. How many organisms are there in this system? I think that's just a bad question. And I think the answer, where the organisms are, really depends on why you're asking, what you're trying to do. So, you know, maybe there are evolutionary questions that mandate the more traditional view of organisms as just either single cells or sets of cells derived from a single lineage. But if you're interested in functional biology, there are many different ways that you'd want to do this. Okay, so what I want to suggest is that the way one should see a system like that is as a set of processes deeply entangled and interconnected with one another. And once you see that, you can kind of understand why you shouldn't worry so much about the question how many organisms there are. And even a relatively simple thing like these branches, how many branches are there? I think that's probably not a good question. Certainly if you look again at the famous classic example of the river, which is a river, which is a tributary, when does the river become a lake? There are all these questions which, again, really without a motivation, a specific motivation for asking them, really just are bad questions, so you shouldn't spend your time in the process. The process is connected, or the processes are interconnected and entangled, and constructing boundaries is essentially a conceptual task rather than something that reflects the nature of reality. Finally, before I get onto these consequences, I just want to give a picture of that was going to be, I can't remember what that was. It was a picture, a kind of schema of a lineage of horses, I think. And the group's gone too. I don't know where that happened. That's strange. Okay, well, that was just a bunch of horses looking very cute together. The point about this is that what I want to stress is that this hierarchy, which is to some degree, of course, arbitrary, I mean, where you draw the lines between it, but for any particular question, we can ask, what is a system? What are the components of that system? But when we actually try and understand the relations between these systems and their components, it's always two-dimensional. I sometimes like to say dialectical to really stir things up. But, I mean, just to take an example in the middle, we're all, you know, very familiar with understanding the heart as a kind of system made up of tissues and molecules that, you know, we hope interact in a certain way to maintain the pumping action. But of course, we also know that the maintenance of the heart requires us to do things ourselves, like exercise. And of course, the system, the healthy, well-exercised system, is required to pump blood through the heart and maintain its stability by feeding it with oxygen, nutrients, and so on. And I think the same can be said at all of these levels, and all of these levels, the stabilization of the entities within it is a matter both of the processes going on inside it and the processes that it participates in as part of a larger system. Now, something I haven't really talked about at all is, of course, one really at some point needs a taxonomy of processes, because the processes that I talk about as maintaining the processes I'm interested in are in some ways different. So the processes that I talk about as stabilized systems are complexes maintained by all kinds of other processes. But I don't think that should be a concern. It's lots of work for anybody who's interested in joining the revolution in looking at the different ways we can classify processes in a dynamic world, which is the one I think we live in. Okay, right. Oh, no, we've got the group. Oh, well, that's nice. I don't know why that... just so not everything is lost. Okay, right. So now I want to just say a quick word about humans as processes, and this is part because I guess when I'm now moving on to talking about why I think this matters, this is a mixture of scientific and philosophical implications, but as a philosopher I'm quite interested in the philosophical implications and asking what a human is. That was a particularly nasty picture of Donald Trump, I should say. So I can see why that got the X through it. And just on the ground to avoid sexism, I also had an almost equally nasty picture of Theresa May. And then underneath that, oh, there's an old one. There's one. And of course, this is obviously, I'm just reminding you of what we all know, that humans are not adult white males. They are processes that go through many different stages. And perhaps I got a, yep. And, okay, I thought there was another slide about that, but never mind. Okay, so that's pretty familiar. Here is a picture that reminds us of what I guess is very common knowledge now, that humans are symbiotic systems, deeply intertwined with all kinds of microbes. And I think Ford Doolittle will have more to say about this later on, so I won't pursue it. Oh, God. Sorry about this. So that was a picture of Adam Smith, and that was a picture of Adam Smith's famous pin factory. Well, not actually his, but a contemporary pin factory. Some of you will be familiar with this as his famous example of the division of labor. And here I just want to just remind you another very commonplace fact, which I think is, again, in this context, is just something that we don't often think about in the right context, that human individuals are very far from being autonomous entities. Indeed, we are parts of very, very complex processes, and I think this is, I mean, of course, I think this is an absolutely fundamentally important point, just from a social and political point of view, because we are actually inclined, you know, the history of social and political thought for the last couple of hundred years has been dominated by this absolutely bizarre fantasy of the autonomous individual. And in fact, we are as far from that as any species on the planet, in the sense that the whole of human evolution, in certainly recent human evolution, has been diversification of functions, dependence on, and you know, we just have to think about going through the day, one's clothes, one's food, one's you know, everything is provided by this very complex system of sociality. So again, I think within this is a sort of reminder of the kind of nonsense one can get into in thinking too much in terms of substances as, again, autonomous, potentially isolated individual beings, when in fact we are just parts of complex systems, even though it's not to say there aren't interesting things to say about the way we construct individuality. This is only a very, very much part of the story of human existence. I guess this is something I think maybe is slightly at a tangent, but another aspect of that's very important here is that organismic processes have this mutual interaction with their environments. And again, I mention it here just because it's so extreme in the human case that our stability, our ability to persist as the kind of beings we are, is fundamentally dependent on ways in which we construct the environments we live in. And in particular, I wanted to emphasize our developmental environments, because I think this is, you know, again, in a process perspective, one wants to look at how the life cycle is stabilized. I should actually mention one rather esoteric sounding, but really not esoteric distinction, which is the distinction between stabilization of a structure and stabilization of a process down a certain trajectory. I could, again, this could take me into a little digression into the little flowering of process biology in the first half of the, or around the middle of the 20th century, but I should probably refer somewhere here to, at least to Conrad Waddington and his wonderful distinction between homeostasis, the maintenance of structure, and homeoresis, the maintenance of trajectory. And here I'm talking about homeoresis, the way that we manage to keep producing adult humans with the capacities and the qualities that are required for them to be stable in the context in which they live. And of course, education, medicine, are all parts of those environments that we construct for the homeoretic stabilization of our own developmental processes. Okay, summary then. Humans are highly symbiotic, highly social organisms, survived by complex collaborations and by construction of... one of these screens has gone off, but I guess I can carry on with one. It's great to have two, isn't it? This is... redundancy would have been a very good topic for this. Humans are not autonomous individuals. And again, as I said, the classic liberal individual is an abstraction from a profoundly integrated flow of human and other life. That's my conclusion so far. Okay, the other set of implications. I think that process thinking is very important for thinking about medicine. So I guess probably even an orthodox conception of medicine is got this system, maybe even a mechanism that is that's broken, and we need to find the broken bit and fix it. Now, I think that this is, I mean, sometimes is an adequate view, but if you think of the human as a process, the central mission is really rather to think of how it maintains itself, to think of maintaining the stabilizing processes and finding interventions that maintain, fortify or restore these processes. And I'll try and illustrate this with one example, because I think cancer is the example that we're most likely to think of in an inappropriate way in the first way in terms of the broken machine. And cancer, of course, is a process. Human development and persistence involves a complex process of cell division, cell differentiation, and cell death. That's what the homeoretic stabilization of the human life cycle involves. And it is an exquisitely complex process. It's kind of nearly miraculous that we managed to stay on this trajectory with just more or less the right number of cells of all the different kinds that constitute our bodies. When that goes wrong, many of those failures are things we call cancer, i.e. a failure to provide the right kind of differentiation, or the failure to provide cell death at the right point. And I think that the problem from a process perspective is we shouldn't really think so much about why we get cancer. The real question is why we often don't get cancer. And this doesn't, of course, you know, this is not going to immediately solve the problem. Indeed, it actually leads to a somewhat pessimistic conclusion. It's very unlikely there's going to be one explanation of cancer, given the complexities of the stabilization of this system, and therefore very unlikely there's going to be a cure for cancer. Now, I guess neither of these are terribly surprising conclusions nowadays. And I guess if one's going to be optimistic, one thinks, well, maybe there might be many cures for many different cancers, but I think that it's at least a perspective that might be helpful in thinking more realistically about what the problem is. A final thing, and I guess I mentioned this because, actually Lisa mentioned my first book a quarter of a century ago, The Disorder of Things. This is something, and I guess I just take that excuse, though obviously I had the slide, so I can't really claim the excuse, for just mentioning that one of the rather disturbing things, as somebody who's been interested in kind of disunity of things and, you know, kind of changes and so on, is that I find that my philosophical thinking has a disturbing coherence to it over time. And what I've come to realize is that I was always a process philosopher long before I knew it. And the way to understand why, in particular, reductionism isn't true, and actually most of the other things I used to think back when I wrote that book, is to realize, and this is that the disorder of things, as as we've heard, is perhaps an unfortunate title. Because the disorder is really, of course, a disorder of processes. And the disorder of the things comes about because, in a certain sense, there are no things to be disordered. So they refuse to behave in the orderly way that so many philosophers have expected them to behave, thinking of them as stable, even sometimes immortal, things that actually don't change, the kind of Parmenidean view of the world. And so I think that once one sees what we thought of as things as semi-stable eddies in this process of this flow maintained both by the higher level structures that it participates in and the lower level constituents that makes it up, it becomes crazy to imagine that this purely bottom-up approach could possibly be sufficient to give us an understanding of what went on in such a universe. And I guess, yes, I'm about coming to the end of time. So that was going to be a picture of the recent book that Lisa mentioned, and my excuse for plugging it is that it's free, and you can get it downloaded from the Oxford University Press website. The whole thing is free, so I don't want to say you have no excuse for not reading it, but should you want to hear more about this process revolution, this is a place you can look, and if you don't like it, you won't at least feel you've wasted any money. So with that, I shall come to an end.
You make your case very convincingly, as far as I'm concerned, about life as a process, but does that distinguish life? Because arguably, the whole universe is subject to entropy. Mm-hmm. And cosmology can tell us stories about their life cycle as a metaphor of stars and planets. Mm-hmm. So isn't this just an anti-Platonic, anti-Parmenian argument that everything flows, contrary, and are we talking about life or just about everything?
Absolutely, I completely agree with you. I think I said at the beginning, just very much in passing, my own view is that everything flows, and I certainly, but I think it's as a matter of strategy, expertise, and so on, it's sometimes better not to take everything on at the same time. So actually, one of my postdocs on the ERC project was specifically interested in what I think is perhaps the, you know, in a way, the real stopping point for people who are, you know, persuaded some of the way is chemistry. And so I think he's come up with some lovely ways of understanding that chemistry is absolutely as fluid as biology, and indeed as physics, which again is probably a soft target. So I absolutely agree with you, but having said that, I think if I were to, instead of an argument that life is process, say an argument that everything is process, I would just A, exhaust my competence more quickly, and B, provide more targets for people to disagree with. So, but that would, that's my view. I totally agree.
So this is a kind of a small thread in your
book.
A larger argument. But I wanted to push back a little bit on the characterization of mechanisms as anti-processual. Mm-hmm. There was that suggestion, at least, that there's the broken mechanism, broken machine, is to be opposed to a process view, an anti-reductionist view. Mm-hmm. And yet a lot of the work in philosophy and biology that's devoted to looking closely at sciences that are aimed at discovering mechanisms explicitly may not emphasize processes as much as you, but does seem to emphasize process and activities and a mechanism for this, and also share some of the anti-reductionist.
Yep.
So I just wondered if you wanted to say a little more about that opposition.
Yeah, that's a very good question. Because part of the problem, I think, is the, I guess most people get familiar with the mechanistic movement in philosophy of science. But it's a very diverse movement.
Yes.
Now, if you go back to the classic founding document, I guess the McNamara, Darden, Craver paper in 2000, that's explicitly dualist.
Yes.
There are things and there are processes. You can't have a process without things undergoing processes. Now, that's clearly, so against that, obviously, I want to say, but the things are really another kind of process. The other extreme, probably somebody like Bill Bechtel. The issue I have with Bill Bechtel is whether he's really a mechanist or not. In different moods, I've heard him say that he's not really a mechanist. My view is that, of course, we can't do without mechanistic thinking. The problem is just, as I just alluded to, that we have to remember that certainly in biology, I would say everywhere, but sticking to biology, when a mechanism is an abstraction from the flow, it's an abstraction, and mechanistic explanation works to the extent that the constituents, the things that we refer to in describing the mechanism, are sufficiently stable over the time period that we're interested in, that they can be treated as things. I think I have no problem with mechanism with that proviso. But then with that proviso, so many descriptions of mechanisms are abstractions that have lost sight of their abstractness. And that's the reminder that the process thinking, I think, owes to those mechanistic stories.
I'm sorry, behind.
Oh, that's fine. So I have a question specifically about organisms and the different levels So you go through, you say, obviously, if you in any process ontology, especially biology, you're going to have all these different possible level hierarchies. And so I would want to say, yeah, I totally agree with that, and like the process philosophy stuff seems right to me, but I would still want to say, so I would want to say, and then I'm kind of curious what you would say, that the organism is not merely one amongst many different levels, that it has a certain kind of priority over the other levels, and so they have to operate in relationship to it. So you obviously you can't get an individual, like if you shoot a dog out into space, it's going to die, right? It needs its environment, it needs the other things, so it's kind of not. But so thinking of like in what you and Nicholson were saying in the manifesto, and so I was thinking specifically of E.S. Russell, right, of how strongly he was pushing the organism. So Russell said, biology should be the study of living individual organisms, which it definitely is not now, right? Most biologists would think that organisms aren't that important. You study the genes, you study cellular construction, or you study species-level population interactions. So, granting that there is a hierarchy, is there a privileged position to the organism?
Thank you. I would say not, but I would say not because I think that I think it's true that there are individual organisms that have a very special kind of status, and of course this I get comes back to that's obviously a topic of evolution of individuality, which has been quite a major topic in evolutionary thinking off and on. And I think that because we so much we have this very strong tendency to think of when we talk about organisms, we tend to think of large mammals. Large mammals have very highly evolved individuality, and it's hard not to think of them as a privileged level of organization. Maybe we should, but then that is a particular branch of the tree of life, if such as there is, and if we were looking at plants, much less so. A lot of plants' individuality is far more diffuse when you have largely vegetative reproduction. Is it reproduction? Is it growth? Whatever. Or at least if you don't have much reproduction, you mainly have growth. And fungi, God knows what to say about fungi, but they certainly, I think they only seem to have much individuality if one looks at the fruiting bodies. I would say that there are parts of the living world where individuality has become a very striking phenomenon, but it's only a local phenomenon, and even then is easily overstated, and I guess that's why I like to bang on about limits of individuality even in humans, where I guess our intuitions tend to be the strongest.
Okay, thank you. So I just want to come back to our ancient philosophy here. They've made this remark about how your Heraclitus and Parmenides, twins in modernity with atomism is basically very similar to what he's talking about. But I was wondering if you or collaborators have dialogue much with the kind of intervening 1500 years of course, in the moment Parmenides doesn't, when Aristotle lives for a long time, and his view of substance is very much focused on activity, where the way you think of what a thing is or how you know what it is through its activity, not through some kind of static properties that is always manifest.
Yes, that's a hard one. Thank you. My temptation is to refer you to the forthcoming next collection of papers, which is on identity, and does involve a mixture of metaphysics and philosophy of biology. I mean, people actually who identify on each side of that, and certainly we have several people there who want to defend an Aristotelian view as the golden mean between substance and process ontology. I honestly don't know if I can really say anything very much about that. I'm not persuaded, but can I tell you why? Probably not. Certainly Aristotle has a much more interesting and nuanced view of organisms and substances than the one that I've sketched here, and this is perhaps something I should be embarrassed by. I think in the end, it is often an essentialist view, explicitly, and I'm not sure that, given that it works, that's to say, I think he needs to be more committed to the process bits that he, as a kind of, you know, admirably empiricist philosopher, is aware of, and less concerned to reconcile his account of organisms with a more general view, which I think is more traditionally substance-like. But it's a very hard question, and I don't have a very good answer to it in a few.
A lot of pressure to be so I had like a question a little bit similar to that, making the question of mechanism a little bit more complex. My guess would be that your theory would be different than, say, a lot of these new sort of free energy principle or quasis theories that are very popular, definitely very procedural, but they have a sort of claim of metastability, a probabilistic metastability, say, right? And so, and they are in that sense mechanistic,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so, like, I was wondering, but your answer back here about it sounded like, oh, these are all problems, but then I think that the position gets a little watered down.
This is certainly another question which I don't have a totally adequate answer to in terms of, but you know, you mentioned autopoiesis. Clearly that's a position that has a lot of common raising. But the name is very disturbing, right? I mean, autopoiesis, it makes itself? No. I mean, I think that is a problem, actually, that goes deeper than just a bad choice of name. That there is... Yeah. And this is, of course, I don't know if you know this, but the San Sebastian group, right, we have a lot of contact with, but I still find the closure that they talk about a little problematic, I think. But, you know, this is in a sense more of, you know, maybe it's more of an internal debate than fundamentally being on the wrong side. So obviously it's very hard to present this kind of thing in a short period without brushing over, you know, all kinds of views that have a lot in common. I mean, I certainly don't.
Yeah, but I would like to say that also, there's a lot I can talk about.
I did want to mention that Aristotle took the trouble to dissect an elephant. To dissect an elephant.
Oh.
So he did take the trouble to look into things.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
My question was based on your statement that we humans are part of a complex system or systems.
Yeah.
And you mentioned how cancer is part of a breakdown of multiple systems, or many other diseases. It's been mentioned that the violence that we've seen in the history of humanity could itself be seen as a symptom of some kind of a breakdown that we would label a public health problem. And within complex systems, there are such pillars as emergence and cascading and that sort of thing. Is it possible, without some kind of intervention, this cascading into violence and mutual destruction would continue with even worse than we've seen?
Thank you. This may be gives me an excuse to try out a particularly crazy idea I've been thinking about lately, which I may, maybe at least somebody will be able to tell me what's wrong with it. I mean, I don't even, I don't know. But I was trying to think, it actually came from thinking about the Eddie analogy, but also then trying to think, and again, this will shock people who thought there was anything in some of my early work, becoming horribly unified. I wondered how much of the whole story might really just be a story about entropy, entropy flow. And I guess one of the things that when I was putting this up, I just came across the idea that actually it's not just as people often think that organisms don't violate the second law of thermodynamics, which of course we all are fairly comfortable with. There's still kind of a little bit of an anomaly for the second. I mean, it surprises us. I mean, why, if you think of this directionality of the universe, this omnipresent directionality, why should we get these very complex structures? And then I guess I came across somewhere the idea that, well, actually, organisms are actually amplifiers of entropy flow. That actually evolution is the evolution of systems that are increasingly better at increasing entropy flow than they would have been without. So that it's kind of an organism as a sort of shortcut towards heat death. I was very trying to figure out, and I realized my maths wasn't up to engaging with the fluid dynamics, but whether possibly eddies in rivers are really a way of getting to the sea more quickly, given a complex topology, and I seem possibly, probably not, but I don't know. But the scary end of this thought, and this is why it has obviously an answer to your question, is the thought that humans, and of course we shouldn't say we're at the peak of evolution, but we're awfully successful, are of course, you know, wonderfully good at increasing entropy flow. I mean, so much so that we're pretty much reducing, you know, we're pretty much reducing the planet to heat death. We've become so good at increasing entropy. And so possibly, an answer to your question is, yeah, we're just really good at making a total mess of everything. And evolution as an enhancer of entropy flow has come up with the final answer pretty much in us as just unbelievably good at finding all kinds of ways to make an utter mess of everything.
There's just one final question.
About this parochial individuality of humans,
yes.
One aspect of it is that in the sorts of societies which people evolved, it was possible for individuals to leave one social group and enter another, mm-hmm. often very difficult, mm-hmm. but in some such mm-hmm. ecosystems of different mm-hmm. groups, such as the indigenous peoples of this part of North America, mm-hmm. a boy, or occasionally a girl, who was captured in the rain, whose own group is being wiped out, not to adopt it into the new line when they had a need for that in their group. And this they knew they could take a boy. And of course, he couldn't live on his own, but he could tell a warrior in your group instead of the enemy group that the warrior against that he came from. So that's just one reason in which individuality is taking its privilege. Right. Among humans, they couldn't grab someone's kidney and use it as a transplant, but they could take a whole kidney of the group and make that person part of their own.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, one thing I think I said earlier in the discussion, I mean, I do think, you know, large mammals have a very high evolved level, a highly evolved individuality. It's just that we overstated. I guess the other thing, though, the other concept that I haven't mentioned at all in this talk, but probably is very fundamental to the topic, is plasticity. I mean, and humans are enormously behaviorally plastic, and the younger they are, the more plastic, no doubt. If you take young humans, they can be pretty much grown up in almost any of these social structures. So I don't think I should be concerned about that. I mean, of course, if you mean they are, you know, kind of units of you know, kind of movability around the social world, of course, yes. But you know, there are other units. I mean, we now take organs and transplant into other systems. When you look at the symbiotics, multi-species symbiotic systems, many organisms from a particular species can form parts of many different multi-species symbiotic wholes. So that requires, of course, I mean, the units of reorganization are something like organisms. But they don't necessarily have to be organisms. I mean, the movable parts are not typically autonomous. They're just capable of becoming parts of very different wholes. So, yes, I mean, of course, because I'm making that, what I'm trying to make a rather perhaps counterintuitive point, I no doubt overstate it. I mean, there are. I also think, I mean, that one of the reasons I do that is I think that we have a particular social history in the part of the world we live in where the individuality has been exaggerated and reified in very extreme ways. But of course, it's not that there's nothing there, or that this, you know, whether, you know, the number of people in this room is a pretty objective fact. I can't just decide to call three of you an organism.
Lots of great issues to discuss, which will continue throughout this afternoon. But let's thank Professor Dupree again for.